Hello, and welcome to That's Life, Spectator Life's sideways look at the world today. I'm Benedict Spence.
And I'm Andy Shaw.
And on this new podcast, we'll be sitting down every few weeks to enjoy a bottle of wine with comedians, politicos, prostitutes, clergymen, misanthropes, oddballs, endangered species, unwanted children, and anything else we can scrape up off the street to try to get a laugh out of. We may even have some of your favourite spectator writers joining us every couple of weeks to ponder the amusing events, individuals and words that have cropped up in the news recently.
To kick off, we're joined by the comedian Simon Evans. And for those of you who don't know Simon, he's performed stand-up everywhere from the Edinburgh Fringe to Live at the Apollo. And the Scotsman recently gave Simon's latest show the tag of genius and awarded five of their golden stars to it.
That's correct, yes. Although that wasn't my most recent show, in fact, that was the last show. And I called it genius in order to lure that kind of review out of them.
To trick the Scotsman into calling you a
genius.
And
they said, genius, question mark? And that was the quote.
Those of you who are also still clinging to Radio 4 will also have heard Simon Evans Goes to Market, a series of light-hearted lectures on economics. And we're delighted to welcome Simon to be our inaugural guest. Simon, thanks for joining us
today. Thank you. I wasn't aware I was inaugural. I would have dressed up a little bit, but never mind.
Now, we here at Spectator Life, we like to do things a little bit differently to the spectator proper, that high-octane world of well-heeled, politically savvy and erudite people. We'd like you to think of us more as the sort of laid-back, fun-loving and barely employable second cousin.
To that end, we shall be taking a novel approach to our podcasts. And in front of us, we have a couple of rather nice bottles of wine that will be finished off quicker than you can say Jean-Claude Juncker. This is a 2017 Blason Côte de Rhône Village. And Spectator Life's wine expert, Jonathan Ray, described it as an autumnal red, juicy, jammy, full of spicy plums, loganberries and black cherries.
Did you know, by the way, Jonathan Ray, a good friend and neighbour of mine in Brighton, was our next door neighbour but five for just over a year, Johnny and Marina, very nice people, and hosts really splendid parties on the remains of his various reviewing jobs.
Yeah, did he help you stock your cellar or did you just drink his wine?
We just drink his, and also he gets those whiskies that arrive in with handwritten labels. That's when it really gets exciting, just in sort of laboratory-style glassware.
Well then, everybody, cheers.
Cheers.
Simon, now that you've had some of them spicy plums in your mouth.
Yes.
How's your week been?
Very much like that. Did I mention Brighton? Yeah, it's been a good week, actually. I was in Edinburgh for pretty much the whole of August, left that on bank holiday Monday, and Edinburgh is like a return to university for stand-ups in a really good way. Everything is walkable, all your favourite people are a short, you know, hop away, and it's all about you. You know, the whole city is about you and your industry. There are posters everywhere of comedians. People come to see you every single night. You get really used to the routine of getting up, nothing to do except, you know, keep yourself fit and healthy enough to perform that night and then, you know, drink it all away afterwards. And it, coming back after that, back to Hove, does feel a little bit like you've been sent into exile. You know, I do feel myself stumping about Napoleon style on the beach, you know, gazing out across the water and wondering what my next campaign might be. But things have started, you know, wheels have started turning again this week, so that's good.
Well, you've got a fantastic tan. You've clearly spent quite a bit of time on the beach.
Actually, just yesterday, I walked about 12 miles up and down the seafront. Really beautiful day, and I was listening to the last third of the Godfather audiobook, so I'd indulged myself for the last 8 hours of that. But I think I got a bit too much, and I don't have the ability to metabolise sunshine very well. I find it gives me indigestion. I had a very strange, slightly hallucinatory night sleep. I genuinely do get a little bit like a kind of fever-like strange dreams if I get too much sunshine. I don't know what is going on there.
Well, you have to elaborate on that now. What were you seeing? Who was that?
Oh God, I can't remember, because they are dreams, you know, and they do just vanish when you turn the lights on and you know, and you're like, what? You know, I don't know what was happening. Do you know, it's ironic listening to The Godfather and all these Sicilian men who've moved to New York for a better life, you know, and some of them do feel a lot like I feel in Hove, you know, there is that longing for the old country, but they are at least able to stomach their wine, they are at least able to cope with it, you know. Two glasses of red and a hot day and I really am wasted.
I
would not make my bones.
Maybe you could start a protection racket on the local vegan restaurants or something. I mean, just, you know, try and try and bring some of these cultures together.
Do you know what? I mean, Brighton has its own very, very colourful... I will one day write The Godfather of Brighton. I think there's a real scope for that. It's a hotbed of small-time criminals.
Well, talking on the subject of organised crime, yes, there's been a lot going on in the European Union this week. There's been rather a lot of stuff going on in politics this week. I mean, with Boris Johnson turning up at a podium and then not, as it turns out, turning up at a podium. Plenty of other things going on.
That was odd, wasn't it? That I felt like that was a bit of a gotcha, but I think it'll blow over. The thing is, at the moment, there are endless humiliations. Some of them are staged. Some of them he just wanders into in his own charmingly buffoonish way. But they're all overtaken the very next day by something even more absurd. And none of them leave any stain on him at all, in my view. And I don't think the electorate give a damn about these kind of obvious... You know, it's very much like what happened with Trump 3 years ago, and I'm on record on the News Quiz saying this. People do not understand that there's such tribalism in politics now that if you've picked your team... And then they are confronted by some hideous humiliation of that kind, and they get away with it to any degree at all. You just love them all the more. It's like supporting Arsenal, and they still manage to come out 2-0 ahead despite an absurd, you know, foul just outside the area. Like, yes! You know, this is what happens, and this is so. There's no, you know, there's no political capital to be had from humiliating these people. Mm.
But it must be said, for once, Boris isn't the only show in town.
No.
Anything else that's caught your eye this week? Any moments that stand out for you?
Well, I've enjoyed, I suppose, probably moments. I would have to say the most amusing one was a Johnson. I don't know whether it was amusing. It was illuminating, certainly. The Johnson interaction with the unhappy father at the hospital. That John, and as always with these things, the initial event or press opportunity is overtaken very swiftly by what becomes the news story. My suspicion is partly it's because people find actual news quite indigestible. They struggle to work out what's supposed to be going on. They struggle with the actual nuances of policy. And as soon as somebody can put their foot on a banana skin, that's far more interesting and entertaining. Johnson shows up at a hospital for what he claimed. There was no press. He claimed it wasn't a particularly supposed to be a high-profile visit, but he's immediately confronted by this angry father who's, I think, his wife had just given birth, I think. And he's confronted with Johnson. You've come down to try and get, you know, good publicity out of this hospital. And in fact, the Tories have been, you know, running the NHS into the ground in the hope of selling it cheap to Donald Trump's friends or whatever the current narrative is about the NHS. And then Laura Koonsberg discovers that he's actually a Labour activist, which didn't take much discovering because it's like the first three words on his Twitter account. I'm a Labour activist plus NHS. And she releases that. And everyone goes into this kind of weird fury about who is doxing, you know, is that a spectator word? Is that a spectator-friendly word? Doxing is releasing somebody's personal details, essentially, so that they can be trolled more effectively. She didn't, like, post a picture of the semi he lives in or whatever, you know, but she's basically released his Twitter account. Then he's gone, that's fine. And then another picture emerges where he's got, he's been mic'd up for this interview. What appeared to be... Have you not seen this? Yeah.
No.
He's got a little... He's got quite clearly what is one of those little black battery pack sort of remote control Wi-Fi miking devices is tucked into his belt as he turned around. So the whole thing was completely staged. I mean, it's... I saw a talk given by Brian Eno about 20 years ago. Brian Eno, you know, record producer and sort of movie... Svengali type figure, and not movies, but music Svengali. He was talking about David Bowie's wedding and how it had been his first experience of something which didn't really happen in reality. It was an entirely stage managed event in which various aspects of the wedding were redone for different camera angles and so on. They actually had like the vows done two or three times with different cameras in place. And he said, this is like this kind of, we're moving into this era now with celebrity events of this kind where you can't... Well, I didn't mind that too much because, to be honest, a wedding is kind of nonsensical like that anyway. All weddings are nonsensical. Any wedding you've ever been to, things are restaged for the benefit of the photographers. It didn't seem to me that they were taking huge liberties. And even Brian Eno himself wasn't aware, I think, that he was later to appear in a photo at that wedding standing next to Yoko Ono and Bono out of U2. So they had Eno, Ono, Bono all in a line, which Bowie had obviously set up, and he was just like genius at it. But now you're getting to this point where news events seem to be created with the same sort of level of, I don't know,
cynicism. Nobody, really.
Yes, cynicism. It will undermine people's trust in what they're seeing.
Well, it's interesting, in the video you see of the guy haranguing Boris, Boris says there's no media here. And he says, yes, there is media here. And he points to the camera.
Yeah.
So it's obvious.
Yeah.
It's the media I invited here. Exactly. So of course there's a media here.
What do you think this is? Top liver?
Little mic is on me.
Boris probably saw his mic and thought, ah, oh, sound man. Yes. Excellent.
Boris turns up to get an ingrowing toenail looked at. Wonders where all the reception staff have gone because they formed an audience around this guy.
He's just hoping to have his kind of posture improved a little bit so that he can buy a new suit. Yeah.
Andy, anything you have to add to that? Any moments this week that have stuck out for you beyond Boris Johnson mistaking a protester for a sound man?
Well, my moment's actually caused by the Polish ambassador, Arkady Rzekotski. We don't hear from him often enough, I think. Every time I hear him speak, I think he's an interesting guy. And he's just written to all of the Poles living in the UK. So he's written to about 800,000 Poles living in the UK. And the pretext of the letter was to say, you know, if you haven't applied for settled status, you should apply for settled status because so few people have, because people don't like dealing with paperwork.
This is like an individual letter, though.
It's an individual letter to everybody, every Pole living in the UK. But he finishes the letter with saying, why don't you come back to Poland? Because by the way, Poland's been growing every single year for the last 28 years. The current GDP growth rate, something like 6.5%.
Yeah,
actually,
it's
a lot better. I spend some time in Poland. It's fantastic, the development over there. But the letter really was a sort of pretext to say, well, come back to Poland.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting because there's clearly a bit of a campaign going on in that light. A few weeks ago, they slashed the income tax rate for everybody under 26 in Poland to zero.
Bloody hell.
To say, you know, stay in Poland. We don't want people to go. And now that's my moment of the week.
Yeah.
What I'd love to be a moment of the week is a debate between Andrew Adonis and Arkady Rzekotski arguing over where Polish people should live. Andrew Adonis saying, come and support our NHS, and the Polish ambassador.
Just think,
if only
people had known that, all these people applying for Irish passports would have been desperately rummaging around for Polish citizenship to try and get Polish passports.
I have some Eastern European DNA, I've discovered. I'm looking into Poland. I have a few Twitter correspondents who live there, and it sounds like a very interesting place, you're right, and thriving in all sorts of important respects, and sort of very culturally positive and confident at the moment as well. Which is interesting because a lot of Eastern European countries have actually been devastated by the EU, haven't they? I saw a talk given by, I can't remember his name, I wish I could, a proper expert on Bulgaria in particular, but other sort of post-Soviet states in the sort of post-EU era. And I think they've lost something like a third of their population.
That's
Bulgaria,
right.
It's just, just disemboweled. And they are, of course, the get-up-and-go third as well. I mean, they're precisely the third that every country needs if it's going to perform, you know, with any degree of success economically. They've all gone. Whereas Poland does seem to have this kind of success story going on.
It does. I was reading a little bit more about what the Polish ambassador had written, and he said that 1.7 million people have left Poland in the last 15 years.
Mm.
What's also interesting is 800,000 Ukrainians have moved into Poland.
Moved in, right.
So, you know, it's like everybody's moving.
And how are they treated? Is that like harmonious?
It is, but, you know, you order a pizza, get a taxi, you know, it's all the Ukrainians who are doing
it,
and they now have a sort of special status.
They don't
want to
share
status.
The one language that they've probably had in common for the last 50 years, I suppose, do they? Because that's a bit loaded now.
That's
a
surreal. We'll take the bit back and next, you know.
That's a surreal thing, imagining Polish nationalists sitting there going, bloody Ukrainians coming over here with their work ethic.
Well, we think we invented that kind of thing, but I'm afraid we didn't. You know, that is pretty universal around the world, isn't it?
One of the things that struck up is, of course, it's been the start of party conference season this week, and we've had the Liberal Democrat Party conference, and the thing that really stuck out for me, it wasn't a particularly large moment, it was the sight of all of these new Lib Dem MPs who have all crossed over from the Tories and Labour. They were all engaged in a photo opportunity where they're all walking towards the sea. And my theory on this is that the Liberal Democrats have switched from the party of second referendum to all out remain and revoke. And I think that's because they've been in Parliament listening to the man who shouts stop Brexit on the hour every hour so often that they thought the public clearly wants this. And in the same way, they've been listening to people telling them to get in the sea and have also thought, do you know what, maybe this is actually also a very popular policy. So that's why that happened, because apart from that, it... I don't really see what the point of that.
It's not strong messaging, is it?
It wasn't.
Again, as I may have mentioned, I live in Brighton. Last night, while I was walking on the last lap of the seafront, all the massive security barriers and so on were being erected for, I think it's the Labour Party conference that's going to take place there next week. And of course, nowadays they have to have huge sort of concrete deterrents all the way around these things, which is very sad. And I couldn't help feeling, in Corbyn's case in particular, a little bit hypocritical, frankly. You know, he's generally speaking in favour of terrorism being available as a means of expressing your views in Brighton, isn't he?
That was the Israelis that was his traditional approach. I mean, unless he's worried about the IDF. Now, my co-host Andy, you might be interested to know, is currently in the midst of writing a book, a bullshit dictionary, which is going to be offending all the senses in every way, shape and form. He's collecting words and phrases that are widely used to confuse, obfuscate, or to pursue particular political agendas, rather than clarify or help people understand the world around them. Now, we're going to make our way onto the second bottle of wine, but we need to get this out of the way before we start dribbling in the corner and slurring our words. So I was wondering, Simon, would you be able to help Andy out? Do you have a word that I think perhaps sums up the week that's just been, that he might want for his bullshit dictionary?
Well, it's, for me, one of the most important events this week was my own Radio 4 documentary going out, which went out on Monday and was repeated on Wednesday, but which you can hear on the Sounds app, depending on when this one goes out, if you haven't had enough of my voice in podcast form. And it was called Simon Evans is Right, and it was examining right-wing comedy, essentially, what is a perceived bias in BBC comedy in particular of a sort of left-wing bias, and whether there was anything to it, whether it mattered and all that sort of thing. And partly because of that, and partly because it just is happening at the moment. In fact, since I recorded that show, a number of Netflix specials, Dave Chappelle and Bill Burr, perhaps most famously a few months ago, it was Chris Rock, are massive, huge, multimillionaire American comedians coming out very strongly against what they call cancel culture. So I thought I'd choose my word would be cancelled. Cancelled culture. It's an expression which has a sort of chilling, kind of Orwellian detachment. And do you want me to pause and
somebody's
say that again?
Somebody's just been cancelled in live action. A moment of silence for our cancelled comrade.
That's cancelled culture out there. Yeah, cancel culture, which is the idea that if somebody is exposed as having crossed some kind of line into a wrong think, deviant behaviour, whatever in the past, they can be retrospectively judged and found wanting and removed, essentially, in quite unapologetically Stalinist terms. They can be extracted from the record. They can be struck. I was having a quick conversation with somebody on Twitter about this, very intelligent, erudite individual who sort of has started following me under obviously some sort of massive misapprehension as to the kind of quality of content I'll be producing. But for the time being, it's great talking to him. And he says this was, I can't remember, I wish I could remember the name of some academic who was studying the use of this kind of attitude and this process by the Nazis to remove words they didn't like or change the meaning of words. How if you can change the meaning of words and you can control the language, of course we all know this is 1984 and so on, but every week brings new examples of words being adapted to a new purpose, and you are eventually unable to discuss what is actually happening in the correct, you know, plain English version. And cancel is a good example. And he said, this academic who's talking about it in Nazi Germany said, this builds up in society very much like the accretion of arsenic poisoning in a human organism, that it will gradually build up until it overwhelms the ability of the thing to survive at all.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because words are used with an agenda behind them. So in that context, appropriate is so widely used now. So it's a question of judgment. Is it right or wrong? Is it good or bad? And then if you make that judgment, you have to justify it. And you have to say, this is why I think this is wrong.
Or you say but it's problematic, which is a way of saying, I can't even tell you why it's wrong. But
it's like, you know, I don't have to justify why it's wrong. It's just you are wrong. Yeah. Doing it is wrong. But there's no need to explain or win people over to a particular viewpoint. It's just a way of effectively labelling it as beyond the pale.
And what is happening, which is worrying, is that they have invaded, they've broken into what was the sacred space of comedy. The idea that all bets were off, that there was privilege, very much like parliamentary privilege. There was comedy privilege, and you just say things because you're only having a laugh. And I'm not saying it was without consequences, but nevertheless, there was a feeling, you know, that you shouldn't be judged, certainly by a joke you cracked 15 years ago, you know, or by your attempt to address the issue of the culture itself, and it comes out snarling. And there is an extraordinarily, palpable hostility, a kind of seething, hissing It's quite frightening, actually. So, I think if you were on the wrong side of it.
So where do you think it comes from? Because that sort of reaction usually comes from fear.
Yeah.
What do you think people are really frightened of?
Obviously, it's a huge subject. I mean, your colleague Douglas Murray has just published a book this week on the things like race and gender and trans issues and all the various identity politics which are distorting people's ability to just get along with one another at the moment. This is a story. We start talking about this. We've got a siren.
What
and now we've got a helicopter.
They're all coming for us, and we haven't even said it.
Actually, Simon, I don't know if you know, but you're about to be cancelled, and that helicopter
it's the cancel
is coming
chopper.
Down.
I was thinking.
I'm thinking it's
a brave topic for our first podcast that we're going to talk about being cancelled and then being cancelled live on air.
I have a theory. There are loads of different, and I'm not saying any one theory will account for any more than 5 or 6% of whatever it, but I will say this one. I think it's interesting that we had, in the 60s and 70s and 80s, there was obviously the civil rights movement, there was feminism, there was gay rights and so on. I think there's a huge determination that momentum continue. And yet there's kind of running out of new things to say. So it has to become ever more shrill, because despite all the available evidence and all the available conversations and the determinations and the elimination of, the right of an employer to discriminate based on his own bigotries or whatever, and you have to, take every account, all of that. Nevertheless, clearly the world is not fully egalitarian. And this is infuriating to people who thought that their processes that they had inaugurated would deliver that, and it has not delivered it. And so there is this rising anger now, I think, that even now we still don't have. In fact, if anything, I would argue, you look on the West Coast, you look where the absolute beating heart of woke culture, which would be San Francisco, Silicon Valley, the great tech companies, it's the most absurdly unequal society ever seen in the developed world. They are literally stepping over human feces, dead bodies, and, the paraphernalia of serious drug use in order to step into their hyper, space capsules and disappear into the Google pod for the rest of the day. It couldn't be a more
problematic.
problematic, depiction of the dystopia.
And back to the Lib Dem conference.
Yes.
Brighton is
where Guy Verhofstadt.
Do you like that word, cancelled? We're going to be putting that in the bullshit dictionary, Andy, or do you have any other suggestions?
I think we should. I think it goes along with words like appropriate and other descriptors which are used to say that, this is beyond the pale and inappropriate.
You should never say it of a person. That's my point, really. Cancel can be an event. And you might say this event has been cancelled because the university can't afford the security because of the but people are cancelled now. This is it. That's a chilling idea. Your whole legacy, your oeuvre, everything you've done is cancelled. Boom, gone.
Well, George Orwell wrote a lot about the use of, the sort of Stalinist, and you gave the sort of Nazi analogy, but the sort of Stalinist rewriting of history and rewriting of the present. And the use of words totally inappropriately. One word that really struck me in the last week or so was coup. Yeah. The great coup d'etat.
Hilarious.
Boris Johnson, sort of fiddles around with the prorogation by a few days to suit himself politically.
Yeah.
And 1,000 people descend on Parliament Square shouting, "Stop the coup."
Yeah.
As if,
the first coup ever to demand a general election be held. You'd be thwarted by
That's right. I do wonder, though, whether Johnson, because fairly soon after that he rushed up to Wakefield to that police recruitment academy.
Yeah,
I don't know if you saw that.
I did, with the fainting police officer.
Well,
the police,
why did she faint? Nobody has asked that question. I think he was trying to recruit. No. Lust for power.
Lust, possibly. Yeah.
Because I think he was trying to recruit, young police into his army to get the 21 rebels. Arrest and torture
Red
a few years down.
It's how it starts. Boris Johnson's
the cultural revolution, isn't it? Yeah.
That's right. But they didn't.
Fire with fire.
But they'd gone there to do a bit of, stopping some antisocial behaviour in his shop.
He is like one of those animals that has got a parasitic worm in its brain now, which, i.e. Cummings, who is so obviously in command of the Boris organism. There's no point in discussing what Boris wants to do.
Are you saying he's incapable?
It's entirely concocted.
Do you think it's like how to get ahead in advertising? It's just little Dominic Cummings boiling at the side. I personally have never had much of a problem with the word problematic. It brings many happy childhood memories back to my school days. It was pretty much a staple of all of my school reports. Now, here at Spectator Life, we like to think that we are highbrow, intellectual types. But at the same time, we recognise that we, and probably you listening at home, are also incorrigible gossips. Now, we're moving on to our third bottle of wine now. Yeah, that's right. This whole podcast is just an excuse for us to drink someone else's wine.
I seem to be taking this far more literally than both of you.
Well, we were wondering, Simon, if there were one person from the last week that really stood out for you, who would that be?
I'm always in awe and admiration of Guy Verhofstadt, the European Minister for Propaganda, or whatever. I don't know what his technical. I genuinely don't even know what nationality is, which I suppose is
Belgian.
He's Belgian, is he? Because I always think he's Belgian, but then am I going, is that just Brussels? Back off, Brussels! But he actually is literally. I mean, is that an ethnicity? I don't know.
I think we need to look it up. But I mean,
Flemish. His enemies portray him very smoothly as Hitler in various side by side comparisons. But and I genuinely admire him. I don't even mean to be snide about this, because he speaks his truth. He speaks his truth without fear or favour. He has a vision of the European Union for the future, and it is precisely the vision which the Brexit majority fear, which is to say ever deeper and more irreversible political union and marching forwards as a single entity and overriding the various vetoes and so on that might, prevent us from operating with as a single mind and a voice as every bit as united as that as China is under its emperor for life and so on. And I genuinely like that, because you get a lot of double talk from European diplomats and ambassadors of one kind or another. But Verhofstadt, he has this vision, and I think that is, he's probably the only one who genuinely gives us any kind of idea of, oh, I see, that's why people are alarmed. It's kind of useful to know. And the fact that he came and did it at the Lib Dem conference was extraordinary.
Oh, it is.
Absolutely wonderful. No, go ahead.
Well, no, I loved it because it was a talk of empire.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, India is not a country.
Yeah.
China is not a country.
To be fair, he's right.
Empire. The future is about empire, the European empire.
Yeah.
But I do wonder, because, he is from Belgium. We have established that.
Mm.
And I wonder if he just felt that he's born a little too late and he missed the Belgian empire.
Which was the Congo and Rwanda.
Those fantastic
old photographs.
If anybody is proposing an empire, if it's a Belgian person, that's not an empire you want to be a part of.
Leopold, God, that was fairly hideous, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But, you have to be fair to them. I think, as part of the overall, the idea that Europe shouldn't be an empire has only ever been anathema to the British, who managed to get one in the rest of the world. For Germany, it was always difficult. They didn't have the sea routes,
They had the willpower.
Too many borders in the way, so they needed to make their empire a little bit closer to home.
What they needed was a bit of can-do British spirit.
Exactly.
Andy, anybody that's really stood out for you this week?
Well, actually, my favourite is General Sir Mark Carleton Smith.
On the subject of empire and military and that sort of thing.
Well, he is the Chief of General Staff, who spoke recently at a defence equipment event. And in fact, I'm going to quote exactly what he said, which is, climate change will have a profound impact on the British Army. The next generation of equipment used by the service must rely on clean technology. And the Army is the leading defence on sustainable energy solutions, both at home and when deployed overseas. So the man who's head of the armed forces sees the biggest issue has been utterly gretted.
He's seen Greta on the sailing ship, and he's thought back to the days of the British Empire and the sailing ships and Nelson. He's thought, that's what I want.
Our only significant military defeat in the last 1,000 years was at the hands of Joan of Arc. I think he's probably seeing it coming all over again, isn't he?
It's quite funny, isn't it, thinking whilst we're going to be, potentially nuking other countries, we're going to be thinking about the environment. It's just that part that we're going to be wiping off the face
of
the
earth. To be fair, historically, the Army and the Navy have had an impact. I think it was Churchill's decision to switch to all oil-fired naval vessels in the First World War is supposed to be the first significant sort of vote of confidence in oil as a transport fuel, I think, at about 1917, something like that. You can actually have an impact in those respects, but I don't think the British military is big enough to have the same impact it did back then, unfortunately.
I think it would be a good idea to have planes on the ships in the first place, before we actually look at how we fuel them. Let's get them off the ground first.
Or we could, you know, Challenger 2 tanks covered in, you know, solar panels. Yes. Little wind farm on the top.
Lovely.
You know, we could have the same effect that Churchill had on oil-fired production for ships.
I used to love making tanks out of cotton reels, wooden cotton reels, notched, and then with a matchstick and an elastic band. Did you ever manage that trick?
They're going to be much more effective.
Yes, they were.
Challenger 2 tanks
elastic
going into the desert
challenges.
Looking for the charging point. Actually, your little cotton reels are going to be the... What are they going to be deploying?
It's not that out of favour. I mean, our current Prime Minister is building buses out of old wine crates. So I don't see why this is necessary.
I find that very touching. Every time they try and humiliate him with one of these things, I go, oh, that's rather a nice thing. My father did some similar things in the evening to unwind. I don't mind a bloke who actually uses both hands in the pursuit of a hobby in the evening. I realise I've come down the rather... But you know what I'm saying. Anything that forces you to cross your hands slightly, it knits the hemispheres together. There's an unexpected benefit.
I'm going to end this, though. There was somebody that I wanted to bring up. Somebody who I think has been much maligned in the last few years. Somebody who's actually had quite a good week. He hasn't lost power in a coup recently. He hasn't had anybody beaten to death, and his wife hasn't spent any of the budget surplus on shopping trips to Paris. Now, yes, Robert Mugabe is dead, but all things considered, he's actually had, for him, a pretty good week. And I think it would just be nice to just end on that, just on that little touching note, to say farewell to the
His
father of Zimbabwe.
His best week for a long time.
Yes, it's gone very well. I don't know if any of you noticed, there were the images of his state funeral held in the National Stadium in Harare. They had little arrows pointed on the coffin to show the pallbearers which way up it was supposed to be facing, or possibly to try and... hopefully direct his immortal soul in which direction it aspirationally wanted to be heading in. But the stadium was almost empty. Now, whether or not that's because most of the people that were invited were otherwise indisposed underground somewhere, I don't know.
I obviously have all the usual views about him, but it was an extraordinary lifespan, wasn't it? I mean, he outlasted the regime, which essentially was a Soviet puppet initially, wasn't he? And he saw it off by about 20 years. I mean, that is really extraordinary in... I believe he died in Singapore or something. I don't know how long he'd been out that way. You know, that might explain some of it, but quite remarkable, quite remarkable. One of those figures that that is genuinely problematic, his life and his legacy, because it does take some unknotting, you know.
In life, Robert Mugabe was problematic, but now has been cancelled.
His adoption of the Hitler moustache, I think, was the...
Is that the giveaway?
He's not even trying anymore, is he?
Simon, thank you very much for joining us.
Absolutely welcome.
We've got one bottle left, I was just thinking... I mean, we probably shouldn't drink this last one. We've been through three now.
Mid-afternoon.
I mean, you can take it home with you if you want, but is there anybody you want to gift it to, maybe? Anybody could do with a glass at the end of a pretty difficult week?
I mean, it's a long-distance gift, but the Spectator offices probably have various sort of hydraulic tubes, do you, at the transatlantic? I think Justin Trudeau could probably do with cheering up a little bit the week. I don't know when this will go out, and it may have all blown over, but his third appearance of historical blackface has emerged online. People have said once can be accidental, twice, you know, might be seen as a coincidence, but three times surely begins to look like a habit. But he's obviously a bit of a party lad, and now he won't have the makeup to cheer him up. He'll probably a bottle of red wine is exactly what he'll need.
So, Justin, if you're listening, there's a bottle of white red waiting for you here.
Absolutely.
So, thank you very much for joining us.
Great pleasure.
And you can listen to Simon's Radio 4 show, Simon Evans Goes to Market, at 6:30 on Wednesdays. And his new stand-up show, The Work of the Devil, kicks off early next year.
That's right.
You can also follow him on Twitter, at Simon Evans, or The Simon Evans, rather. And if you're stuck for other things to do, you can also follow Andy and me, if you're really scraping the barrel. That's at Andy Shaw 1 and at Benedict Spence. Hope you've enjoyed this new podcast, and we do hope that you join us next time. Goodbye.